Kildare Focus with Ciara Plunkett.
You're welcome on into Friday's edition of Kildare Focus. In just a moment, we'll be speaking about the fact that for the second consecutive year, Ireland has been criticised by a key US report on human trafficking for failing to do enough to combat the practice. I'll be speaking about that to Senior Legal Officer at the Migrant Rights Centre of Ireland, Isabel Toulon. Matt McGranahan is spokesperson for Music and Entertainment Association of Ireland. He says the continued closure of the hospitality industry further delays when musicians can get back to work. Culture Night is looming. It's on the 17th of September this year. I'll be joined by Kildare County Council Culture Night coordinator Sheena Malone. They are seeking expressions of interest for taking part in the countywide event. And we'll be talking about flexing even the volunteering muscles with Amy Woods, Communications and Advocacy Manager at Volunteer Ireland. As always, we want to hear from you. Get in touch with your comments, your requests, your dedications by text or WhatsApp to 0833 97 97 97. You can drop us an email if you wish to studio@kfmradio.com, or you can tweet us at KFMradio. Now, a keynote report by the US Department of State, which looks at human trafficking right across the globe, has for the second consecutive year noted that Ireland is not doing enough to tackle the problem. I'm joined on the line now by the Migrant Rights Centre of Ireland Senior Legal Officer, Isabel Toulon. Isabel, you're very welcome to the programme. Hello, Isabel. Isabel,
hello,
can you hear us? Hi, yes, loud and clear.
Yes,
there.
Yes,
for anybody that isn't familiar with this report, sketch out why it exists and why it's done by the US State Department.
So the report exists as a worldwide monitoring system to see what the impact trafficking is having on the world, and I guess how countries are responding to that, what strategies they're utilising to fight it. And the US does a series of human rights reports. They profile each country, and then they profile various issues as well. So trafficking is one of the issues that's pulled out and profiled, just to see how we're doing in the fight against what is essentially a new crime, but not a new crime.
And Ireland has been put, from memory, for the second consecutive year on the Tier 2 watch list alongside countries in the general European area, including Romania, Belarus and others elsewhere. What does that mean?
The watch list is, I guess, a warning system, or like you could say a shot across the bow, I suppose. It means that we are not doing enough to combat human trafficking in Ireland. It means that we have been warned about this, and that we haven't, maybe you could say we haven't heeded the warnings, or that we're just simply not operating quickly enough to fill those deficiencies. We're not doing enough.
Sorry, Isabel, go on.
I'm sorry. So as you said, there were a couple of tiers. There's Tier 1, which we used to be, Tier 2, which we were 2 years ago, Tier 2 watch list, and then there's Tier 3, which are countries that essentially are either in states of conflict, ruled by dictators, or traffic their own citizens, arguably, like North Korea or Eritrea. So 3 is bad company, a bad tier to be on, and we're close to it.
Now, how did it come to be that we have fallen from Tier 1 to the Tier 2 watch list? Have we regressed, or has the rest of the world become more nuanced in its actions against human trafficking?
I mean, the statistics would unfortunately show some regression. Again, it's a new area. We've only had legislation on this since 2008 and then further amendments in 2013. And it's a new area, really, but we are falling. So our victim identification rates have gone down again. It's 38 this year, I believe. It was 42 last year, but that was down on the year before. We have very few prosecutions. We had none for labour trafficking, which is actually the area that MRCI is interested in and specialises in. And we have had, until last month, no convictions under the Human Trafficking Act. That changed, as I said, last month. There was a conviction in the Midlands.
And so that conviction didn't show up in the report by the US Department of State, largely, as I would imagine, because that conviction took place just earlier this year.
Yeah, so there would be certain things that certain improvements that have occurred, and certain things that wouldn't have met the reporting deadline. I believe that was sometime in the spring, so it wasn't being covered. That would be covered in next year's report.
Now, the Department of Justice says it's disappointed by the ranking, and has said that it has made efforts, I would imagine not specifically to improve its ranking, but to improve the lot of people who may be subjected to human trafficking. Has it really made any strides since the last report?
So there have been some efforts, and the tip report notes those as well. There have been some positives. So we would note a couple of things, like there actually was an increase in the amount of people, in the number of people identified for trafficking for labour exploitation, even though the number of victims is down. There's an increase actually in the previous year for labour victims. They have put more money into training. They put more money into public awareness. They put more money funding NGOs, and there are some positive. They've started a stakeholder engagement, so where NGOs and civil society organisations are feeding into policies, and they've appointed a national rapporteur for trafficking in human beings, which has been long recommended and hadn't been done before. That was done within the reporting period. So there are some improvements. There is some reason to be positive, but there are still those chronic deficiencies. I think they're called systemic deficiencies in the report, where we just we have a very outdated victim identification system, which is done by the Gardaí, which they know the department will acknowledge itself it has to change, is proposing to change. It needs legislation. It's going to take time. We have a problem with accommodation, very traumatized victims of trafficking in direct provision centres. We know direct provision isn't fit for purpose anymore, but the report refers to no concrete steps being taken to move people out. We know things will be done. It's incredibly slow.
And if that glacial pace of action in this regard, Isabel, continues, is there a risk we could slip down to Tier 3?
I think that question might be a little bit above my pay grade, but I think there's a lot of calculations that go into that. I mean, I think Tier 2 also exists as a bit of a pressure and a wake-up call, even more than a wake-up call, just to pressure countries into really taking action. I think I can't imagine... I can't imagine what it would be like to go into Tier 3. I think it's unimaginable, so I really hope it doesn't happen.
Well, Isabel Toulon, Senior Legal Officer at the Migrant Rights Centre of Ireland, thank you indeed for joining us. Now, royal fans in Britain have queued for up to 2 hours to get a glimpse of the new statue of Princess Diana at Kensington Palace. I've seen it, I understand the sentiment, not a particular fan of the statue. For some reason, it reminds me of the style of the Peter Pan statue in London. So more than 100 people entered the gardens in the first hour of them reopening to the public this morning. Princes William and Harry unveiled the monument yesterday on what would have been their mother's 60th birthday. In royal news also, but this time in Canada, statues of Queen Elizabeth II and Queen Victoria have been toppled and defaced by demonstrators in Canada. It happened as part of protests over the discovery of unmarked graves belonging to Indigenous children. Hundreds and hundreds of unmarked graves in several sites, 200 or 300 children in each of those sites. That would have a particular resonance with us here in Ireland. So Thursday also marked Canada Day, celebrating independence from colonialism. Downing Street have condemned the destruction of the statues. Get in touch as always, comments, requests or dedications by text or WhatsApp to 0833 97 97 97. Coming up after the break, Culture Night. One of the industries in Ireland affected by the delay of the reopening of indoor dining is, of course, musicians and entertainers. I'm joined now on the line by Matt McGranahan. He's spokesperson for the Music and Entertainment Association of Ireland. Matt, you're very welcome to the programme.
Thank you very much, Ciara.
Devastating for you and all of your members who haven't worked for over 15 months, but I imagine as concerning at this juncture is the uncertainty about when you will be able to get back to work. It must feel like it's last December all over again.
Yeah, I mean, so many musicians and entertainers and crew members and every worker in the industry was really putting a lot of hopes on getting back to some type of work. Some type of employment during the summer months, which is, you know, the naturally sort of busier period anyway for the sector. And so this delay is just really, you know, it's prolonging that fear that there may might be no ability to take advantage of the summer months. Mm. And then we're heading into September, October, naturally busy, quieter periods for the industry anyhow. And so it's very, it's just a bit, people were clinging to that little bit of hope, and it seems to be getting further and further into the distance. But there's a support out there that really needs to be need to really promote to people in the industry, the Music and Entertainment Business Assistance Scheme, the MEBAS grant, which is available. It's the only non-competitive support that has been made available to the sector, and we're really urging musicians, workers, singers, entertainers, crew, sound, lighting engineers, everyone to really get onto gov.ie, go to the department's webpage, take a look at the MEBAS criteria and the eligibility. The deadline's next Wednesday, the 7th of July, for that.
It's a really important point that you've made there, Matt, about it being non-competitive, because, and I'm speaking from skimming reportage on this matter, and it does seem that an overwhelming amount of the supports made to anybody working in the arts, and I would absolutely include musicians, entertainers, etc., in that, seems to have been competitive grant schemes, not non-competitive award systems.
Mm-hmm. It's the way that it's traditionally done, say, through, let's say, the Arts Council. And I'm not being critical here, and what I'm about to say is that, you know, the commercial sector has long paddled its own canoe, hasn't relied or even wasn't being incredibly aware of funding through the Arts Council. and so whenever, you know, the commercial sector had to speak to the Department of Arts and Culture last year, I suppose they responded with what they would have traditionally known. And so it took a long time to make the case for this non-competitive type of support. And in fairness to Minister Catherine Martin, she understood the need for this. And so it got the green light to go ahead to be developed from the end of January onwards. It's not perfect. I'm not going to stand here and say this is just the best thing ever. You know, there are, like anything, there are terms and conditions. There's a minimum turnover of 2019. Of €20,000, we argued for that to be lowered again. It initially began at €25,000. The minister did bring it down to €20,000. But you know, the arts sector, the music and entertainment sector, is notorious anyway, and it's very well documented that there's a very low turnover, low income thresholds in the scene, in the industry.
It's also innately unstable. So, for example, Matt, you could have had an absolutely fantastic year in 2019, in whatever form of the arts you engage, but off the back of 6 or 7 years of just keeping your head above water, and it's the 2019 year on which you would be adjudged.
That's correct, and strangely enough, I've seen, you know, the 2019 year is really where your PUP payments are being determined from as well, in a lot of cases, obviously, because 2020 we had no income. And exactly what you're saying, I know musicians, singers and that who have very busy years, and then 2019 maybe took a bit of a breather to work on new material.
Yeah.
So their income, their turnover just wasn't high enough, and as a result of that now, the PUP payment, you know, isn't what they need to survive. So I think that's the crucial thing is that, you know, if you're a... this MEBAS scheme is really aimed, you know, it was something that MIA have been advocating for day one, you know. And so it's really aimed at those, let's say, for just examples, the one-man band that performs in the pub. Anyone who's doing that on a professional, full-time basis, and who's registered and doing everything properly, this scheme is aimed at them. It's aimed at the sound engineer, the lighting engineer who's working at festivals up and down the country, aimed at all those people. And there's, you know, sometimes a lot of confusion that those people that I've just mentioned don't really see themselves as being a business, even though they're, you know, self-employed, sole trader, but they just don't think of themselves as being a business. And so the language being used to end the scheme is maybe people don't recognise themselves when they read. So it's really important that we're just urging people to get onto the website and check it out. And if they have any questions or uncertainty on it, there's a very good FAQ section on the government website. If they're still unclear, please contact us. You get us on social media, on Facebook, Twitter, the website, mia-ireland.com. checks, so we're only too happy to try and clarify things for people or contact the department directly as well.
Do you have any sense as to how much, and this is awkward to try to guess at, given that the awards won't be made until late July or August, which does mean another few weeks ahead, possibly up to 2 months ahead of people in many ways living hand to mouth, Matt. But do you have any sense as to what the funders expect the average order of a grant to be?
Well, there's three different grants available, and each one linked to previous turnover. So Strand A is a €2,500 grant of turnover between 20 to 50,000. Strand B is a €4,000 grant of turnover between 50 to 100. And Strand C is 5,000 for in excess of €100,000. Now, I also have to add that there is also minimum business costs required for the grant. So for the €2,500, you have to show €3,000 minimum business costs. And so on up the chain. Now, the business costs are from a period of 1st of April 2020 to the end of May this year, the 31st of May 2021. And of course, you know, the question is, well, how in God's name could you have business costs
when
you weren't allowed to?
Yeah.
You couldn't work. But people do have costs. In order to, you know, in order for me to be available to take a gig next week, so if I get the phone call, but first of all, I need a phone, first of all. That's part of my business cost, ongoing business cost, to keeping that business alive so I can spring back into action when I get that call. My car, that's a business cost. My insurance, all those different things that, you know, a lot of, as I say, musicians and entertainers mightn't necessarily consider themselves or operate themselves in a kind of, in a business sort of way, even though they do, but they just take a lot of these things for granted. They don't think of a lot of these things. So, you know, we've had so many people go, I can't make that threshold. When we sit down and start to discuss it with them,
they
realise they can't. Now, we're not in favour of this, the inclusion of this criteria, because it is not in any other government support scheme. The inclusion of minimum business costs is nowhere evidenced in this, than the SBAS scheme or any of the False Ireland business continuity schemes.
Do you have a sense at all, Matt, or even just your best guess, as to why arts in particular has been such an outlier in the way that the supports are constituted? So, as you said, you weren't criticising the Arts Council in so doing, but it reverted to the way it knew best and offered competitive grants. It did so, though, in the context of businesses right across the country being offered non-competitive supports, either through microloans, online trading vouchers, etc., etc. And it only elected to pivot really at the beginning of this year. And then you have the MIBAS scheme, which contains criteria not evident anywhere else in the supports landscape in terms of COVID-19 pandemic.
Yeah, and you know, the MIBAS scheme and the, let's say, the SBAS all have to be approved under the same temporary framework under the EU rules. So why has one got this extraordinary inclusion of this criteria that the other doesn't have? It's a question I'm trying to get answered through the department and also through MEPs. Well, I think, you know, on the wider scale of things, and what you're saying in your question there is, I think it's a lot down to the fact that our industry, from whether that's, you know, the wider arts industry or more specific within music and entertainment, has been left to its own device for so many years. It is completely unregulated. Now, that's a failure on behalf of the people in the industry, but it's also a failure of successive governments to allow this to happen. And this has gone back for years and years. And now, but I think now we're in a position, and this has been, you know, this is worldwide as well. I see it in other countries, and I know from speaking to other musicians and entertainers in different parts of the world, this need for this type of regulation to lift this sector and this professional onto a more professional footing, and to have it recognised properly. I mean, it's when we go to sell this country, it's one of our biggest selling points. We're known globally for it, and we're very happy to use it. And the tourism authorities are very happy to use it and exploit it. And I mean exploit, not in the critical way,
in a positive way. Yeah.
In a positive way, and to use it for that. And so we need now to make sure. I'm aware of examples where professional musicians were were used to exhibitions in different parts of the world to be told, listen, there's no money in it, but we'll cover your flights and accommodation. And that is incredible that that's allowed to happen, or that view is out there. And what we need to do as an industry is to say, no, enough is enough with this. We need regulation to protect ourselves and to protect the future generations, that we actually have a sustainable, protected and renewable industry that contributes so much to the economy, but so much to the social lives and to the mental well-being of people in the country as well.
Well, Matt McGranahan, spokesperson for Music and Entertainment Association of Ireland, thank you for joining us. Now, Culture Night is coming back. It's always a lovely event taking place right across the county. I think the last time that there was a Culture Night, I think there was 80 events around County Kildare, but this year it is taking place on the 17th of September. It'll be really a festival of culture up and down County Kildare. It is an event that is free for members of the public, but Kildare County Council are looking for expressions of interest for projects to take part and for exhibitions to be staged and events to be held. To discuss this, I'm joined on the line now by Sheena Malone. She's Culture Night Coordinator here in Kildare. Sheena, you're very welcome to the programme.
Thanks a million, Ciara. Thanks for having me on.
Delighted to do so. Culture Night is always a really, really lovely event, but I imagine in the run-up to it, you're like, you know, the proverbial duck in water. Calm on the outside, those legs wriggling under the water as it looms ever closer.
Well, that's exactly it. Now, this is my first year now coordinating Culture Night for Kildare, so I'm really excited to take on the role with Kildare Arts Service. But in this year as well, we have certain other challenges that we have to deal with. But we're approaching it with optimism, and we've just recently announced our open call for this year, which we're very excited about. It will take, there's three separate aspects to this open call. And the first one is a mural project, which we are commissioning various murals in the Newbridge and Kildare Municipal District. And I imagine once they're in place, it's going to look absolutely stunning. And the second one would now is our Culture Night Commissions, which is where we are seeking public-facing projects in all art forms, be it art, be it dance, theatre, etc., interdisciplinary art forms that would coincide with Culture Night. And then the third one is our general expressions of interest, and this is the broadest of our open calls. And with this, we're really looking for the public to get involved. So if we're looking for Kildare-based performers, artists, organisations, community groups, shared interest groups, whether your interest is history or dance or music or ukuleles, photography or various different aspects of arts and crafts, we're really interested in hearing your proposals for Culture Night in Kildare this year.
There's really nothing off limits. There's nowhere that you won't go or no form of art that you won't explore or consider.
No, that's the thing about Culture Night. It's Culture Night is all about broadening our concept of what the arts and culture can mean. And in these terms, we would like to broaden our concept of culture beyond what would traditionally have been considered high art and perhaps maybe a little bit elitist in the past. And in this light, we want to create a Culture Night in Kildare that's diverse and inclusive, and where voices from all of Kildare's communities and all across the spectrum of ages can be heard. So if you have a small community group or organization that you might feel that your interests are very niche or very specific, just apply to us, because you might be surprised that you might find a new audience and a new interest that people might get excited about when you share your work with us on Culture Night.
Now, the 17th of September isn't all that far away, but even closer is the deadline for consideration for either of the three tranches, Culture Night Mural Project, Culture Night Commission, or the Open Call for Expression of Interest. How can people let you know, Sheena, that they want to take part?
Yeah, you're right. The deadline is now fastly approaching. It's the 14th of July, which is a Wednesday. So what they can do is you can contact me at on email at culturenightkildare@gmail.com. So that's culturenightkildare, all one word, at gmail.com. Or you can telephone 045-448-328 to contact Kildare Arts Service. And our online form can be found at on our website as well. So if you just Google us, you can find us there.
That sounds fantastic. Sheena Malone, Culture Night Coordinator at Kildare County Council and Kildare Arts Service. And of course, Culture Night taking place this year on September 17th. And you can find, as Sheena said, all of the details on the relevant websites. It's also available on the local news section of kfmradio.com. Now, it's time to flex our volunteering muscles. And to discuss this, I'm joined on the line by Amy Woods. She's Communications and Advocacy Manager at Volunteer Ireland. Amy, you're very welcome to the programme.
Thanks for having me here.
Volunteering is good for you, but if you don't know where to start volunteering, you won't ever be able to get that unintended extra benefit.
Yeah, absolutely. And look, that's something that we hear all the time, that, you know, it's not that people don't want to volunteer. I think a lot of people would consider it. It's a really nice thing to do, but they're just not really sure where to start, which is, I guess, where often local volunteer centres come in to help.
Because there's more ways in which to volunteer or give of your time, or more organisations that need your time and your expertise and your volunteering than you and I combined have had hot dinners, Amy.
Oh my God, absolutely. Like, I think that's one thing that we always try and get across, is quite a traditional kind of image of volunteering. When people think of volunteering, there's a couple of things they might instantly think of, but there's just a huge variety of things out there that people can do. I mean, I've seen volunteer jugglers, I've seen, you know, volunteer gardeners, I've seen, you know, there's so many different things you can think of.
And also, I think perhaps our concept of what it is to volunteer has kind of evolved a lot over the last couple of years, and in particular over the pandemic, because micro-volunteering, which I suppose has always existed, but became more of a thing. People became more aware of it. And the fact that giving even a small bit of your time effectively is valuable.
It has, absolutely. And I think, you know, to quote Tesco, every little helps. And I think that's, again, a kind of a bit of a misconception a lot of people have about volunteering, is you always have to give a huge amount of time for a really long period of time. But there's kind of a lot of smaller things you can do. And like you say, micro-volunteering has been around a long time, but because of the pandemic and we were all stuck at home, it was really suited to that kind of thing. And a lot of people realised that you could just maybe hop online and you could, you know, translate something, and that was really helpful to the organisation. Or, I mean, for example, I think Team Hope are a great example, you know, the Christmas boxes they do every year, asking people to just knit something really small, you know, at home if they can, and send it in to them, and they'll add it into the Christmas boxes. So that doesn't take that long, and it suits a lot of people because that's their hobby as well.
So, Amy, if there are people listening to you and I have this conversation, or saying, look, I'd love to volunteer, I have no idea what kind of organisation, I'm not really sure if the time commitment I can give, or if I have the skills that people might need, where do they start?
Well, first thing here, I'd say everyone has a skill they can share, even if they think that they don't. But absolutely, so there's a volunteer centre in every county in Ireland, and that's there to help people who want to volunteer. They'll help them look at the time they have, the kind of skills they have, what they want to do, and they work with local organisations all across each county to help them find volunteers and kind of provide that matching service. So they're a really good port of call for people looking to volunteer when they don't know what to do.
And the other, I suppose, benefit to volunteering that isn't that much spoken about, because it makes it sound like a cynical reason for going into volunteering, is, and it isn't, is that you yourself will build up your skill base, you will learn new skills, you will make new contacts and hopefully new friends. But the learning of the new skills is a huge and very lovely silver lining.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I've heard so many stories. You know, often we talk about this, people instinctively think of young people, you know, in college maybe, and it is a great way for young people to develop skills. I've talked to many older people as well who've gone into a volunteer role and, you know, learn completely new skills that they never even considered that they wanted before, or those kind of, you know, soft skills that you don't even think of, like people skills and communication skills, dealing with difficult situations, all those little things you pick up when you're in a volunteer role.
And also, depending on the organisation that you're volunteering, it could be also, by accident, a route through more certified upskilling. You have to do, depending on the kind of organisation you're in, child safeguarding courses. You may have to do the TUSLA Children First online e-learning programme. You may have to do COVID upskilling. You may have to learn CPR and things like that.
Yeah, absolutely. Volunteering is a great way to kind of upskill yourself in those kind of more specific skills. So many organizations require really specific skills and they provide that training for people. So it's a great way to build yourself up as well, personally, as well as kind of, you know, for the volunteer role.
So tell us a little about how Volunteer Ireland operates, Amy, and what it is precisely that you do.
Yeah, so we're what we call ourselves a national volunteer development organisation, and what we do is we support the 29 volunteer centres around the country. So on a national level, what we would do is promote volunteering through campaigns like National Volunteering Week, Volunteer Ireland Awards. We manage the National Volunteering Database, IVOL, and then we also kind of lobby on behalf of volunteering. You know, this Ireland's first ever National Volunteering Strategy was published last year, which we kind of played a big role in. Mm. And then locally, the volunteer centres work at a local level with organisations and volunteers, kind of providing that kind of referral matching service that I referred to. They also provide training, Garda vetting, and just kind of those extra levels of support that volunteers and organisations might need in relation to volunteering.
Do you volunteer yourself, Amy?
I do, and actually I'm one of those people, so we talk a lot about the kind of younger people and how they want more short-term flexible roles, and I'm that exact type. So I don't have a regular role, but what I do is I volunteer with the likes of Daffodil Day, I volunteer at the Dublin Book Festival, I volunteer at sporting events. So it's a really nice way for me to be able to get involved in my community, while at the moment I don't have time to commit to something long term, but it means I can still give back when I can.
That's a lovely way, and it also means that for you, you're volunteering, you're meeting new and different people each and every time you give of your time.
Absolutely, and I think one thing that volunteering is great about is it gives you a real different perspective. Like, you meet people you just wouldn't normally meet in your own kind of circle, and it really gives you a different perspective on how other people live, how they view the world, how things go on in other parts of the country. Like, I think it's a really fascinating way to just learn about our communities.
Well, Amy Woods, Communications and Advocacy Manager at Volunteer Ireland, thank you indeed for joining us there.